morning. We have one case on our 10:30 docket this morning, and we'll call that case now. In re Arlington Memorial Hospital. Mr. Tatum.
May it please the court. This case presents a fact situation under Section 74.351 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code that I don't believe has been addressed to this point, and that is what to do when the court, when a trial court grants what we contend are two separate 30-day extensions under the under that section in an effort to allow a plaintiff to correct a deficient expert report. I should make the court aware, and I'm sure the court is aware, that there is an appeal, another appellate matter pending arising out of this case. It is an appeal from the order denying a motion to dismiss for failure to timely file that report that was entered on October 31st. The cause number of that matter is 02080450CV. That motion was filed before the second expert report was filed in the court below.
Do we have the briefs in that? Have the briefs been filed and the appeal?
Appellant's brief has been filed. Appellee's brief is pending.
Would you recommend that we consolidate that with this?
Well, Your Honor, that would probably be efficient. The fact of the matter is, if the court grants in favor or rules in favor of petitioner, it moots that proceeding.
The appeal, so we probably should consolidate.
Right. If it does now, but if the court decides not to grant the relief we're seeking today, that doesn't necessarily moot that proceeding, depending on the court's grounds for its decision. As the court, I'm sure, is more aware than it perhaps wants to be, this section has created an awful lot of controversy over the last few years since it was filed, but it's very clear with regard to at least the element that we're talking about here, and that is that there is only two options that a trial court has if a defendant files a motion to dismiss the expert report offered under this statute because it's deficient. If a report was filed but is considered to be deficient, the court has two choices. The court can grant the motion, dismiss the case with prejudice, or the court can grant a 30-day extension, specifically set out in the statute, to allow the plaintiff a chance to fix what the deficiencies are. It can only grant one extension. And it's Arlington Memorial's position that extension in this case was granted on the record very clearly and in no uncertain terms at the hearing Arlington Memorial's initial motion to dismiss, which was held on July the 19th. We've pointed out to the court the places in the record that we feel demonstrates that. I would also direct the court to the last page of the record, which is included as an appendix to our petition, where the trial court again gives an opportunity or indicates what his intentions are. The very last paragraph, I'm concerned about the extent of the basis of the doctor's opinion, and I'm not going to comment on this point whether you get to go out and hire a new person to come in and offer an opinion, or you just have to have the doctor go back in and elaborate as to what his knowledge is of other hospitals. That, along with the other language cited, the court's intention or the court's admonition that counsel for the plaintiff get cracking, don't waste a lot of time on cell phone calls. There were comments like that. They're all set out in our petition. It's very clear what the trial court's intent was and what the trial court's ruling was that day, and that was to grant a 30-day extension to fix the deficiencies in the report.
So is our only question what notice is required?
Well,
because the statute says the 30 days runs from the date the plaintiff received notice.
That's correct. And the It's our contention, and I think that the reasoning that we've provided from some of the other opinions arising out of this statute supports this contention that, well, a ruling in open court is an effective ruling. Texas law provides that. There's only one circumstance where that isn't true, and that is where there's a time limit on the court's jurisdiction that arises from the date that the order is signed, a final judgment. The court loses jurisdiction over a case after a certain period of time after a final judgment's entered. That's not the case in this case. The court does not lose jurisdiction. The court either is faced with a trial or is faced with, at some point, entering a final judgment of dismissal if the amended report doesn't fix the deficiencies that the court notes during the first round. So there isn't a limitation on the court's jurisdiction that would even bring that principle up.
Mr. Tatum, I'd note that you have raised no objection to the affidavit that Mr. Perrin filed in this matter, in which he states that Judge Evans stated clearly to me and counsel for AMH in his off-the-record discussion that he'd not yet made a final determination as to what his final decision was going to be with regard to AMH's motion. And then goes on to state that counsel did not understand that any ruling had been made, and then later the judge grants the extension, which suggests that maybe this is correct.
Well,
seems like there's some confusion here, misunderstandings at a minimum. I don't know, where I'm going with that, except to just say that it's not clear from this record that Judge Evans' intent at the time he made that comment on the record was to make a ruling granting the motion for extension.
Your Honor, I address that in two different ways. First of all, we do object to that, but second, Arlington Memorial submitted an order several weeks after that, which is also contained in the record, which I think indicates clearly what the court's intent was. And quite frankly, Your Honor, I'm not 100% sure that the court's intent controls because of the way this statute operates. It's our appendix number 7, which provides that on that date, June 19th, 2008, the order mentions Arlington Memorial's objections to the report, motion to dismiss, and motion for attorney's fees and costs. The court, having reviewed that report, entered an order sustaining the defendant's objections to the expert report.
I know where you're going to go with that is that this, by implication, the court granted the extension in making this written ruling.
There's no other option that the court had at that point in time. And I think what we're, that plus the court's clear comments on the record, which I would submit to the court that only matters that are on the record are matters that the court can consider. Both of those things indicate something that the court or that counsel for the real party in interest simply can't get around, which was a clear statement that the extension was granted. The court's motivation, the trial court's motivation later on, I can't speak to. I wasn't there. But the fact of the matter is
we don't have a record of anything that transpired when the court rendered that
the second order. That's right. But the fact is the court did. And it's our contention the court just simply lacked the power to do it under the statute. The court couldn't because it had already granted an extension. Parties were on notice clearly during the hearing, at the end of the hearing, and at a minimum when this order was entered. Because there is nothing else the court could do or could have done but to have granted the extension at that point.
So if that order achieves this other objective of yours, then your position would be that at the very latest, the report was due by August 27th?
Yes.
Plus or minus a couple
days?
That's
correct. Okay. That's correct, Your Honor. At the very latest, the report was due 30 days after this date, and the report wasn't filed until sometime after that. The
What about the fact that this order, the recitals in the order state that it's only addressing or relative to the defendant's motions, which are objections to plaintiff's expert report, motion to dismiss, and attorney fees? It doesn't even mention that this order is addressing the motion for extension that was filed by the plaintiffs.
Because I think the response to that, Your Honor, is that at that point, the court having sustained the objection but denied the dismissal, when a court sustains an objection to an expert report, it has two choices. It grants a 30-day extension or it dismisses the case. There's no other option. When the court here expressly denied the other relief that was sought, i.e. the dismissal and the attorney's fees, then that clearly put counsel on notice that there was an expert report, an amended expert report due in 30 days. That plus the court's comments on the record makes it, I think, very clear that that was what was going on here.
And can you tell us then, one of the issues in this case, of course, is whether this new case, N. Ray Watkins, applies?
Yes.
Which discusses the availability of mandamus relief when an extension is granted.
I don't believe N. Ray Watkins applies because that's not what we're really not talking about, an extension of time. What we're talking about is what we're contesting here today is the order that was signed in October, which we contend was a second extension of time, which is clearly unauthorized. If the court agrees that that was a second extension, that's clearly unauthorized under the statute, and the court lacked the power to grant it, and therefore we contend that under ordinary principles of this court's mandamus jurisprudence, mandamus is available in that situation, and it's just a different situation than Watkins. We understand Watkins to hold that the no mandamus relief is available from the first grant, but that's not what we're talking about here.
Do I understand that you prepared the July 27th order or not? Did you send
counsel
that
for Arlington Memorial? I personally did not, but counsel in my office. Yes, this order was prepared after a period of time had passed, obviously something a little over a month since the hearing in which no orders had been submitted by counsel for Ms. Harris or for the real party in interest.
And so the order you sent in doesn't come out and say that the motion to dismiss is granted, nor does the motion that y'all prepared come out and say that you have 30 days to get your expert report in.
That's correct. This is not a part of the record. The court directed us to submit an order reflecting his rulings on our motion, and that's what we did.
Counsel, I know you're familiar with the rule that applies to mandamus proceedings, that if the evidence is conflicting on a ultimate issue raised in the mandamus, that we leave it alone, basically, that we don't have the power, if you will, to grant mandamus relief when the evidence is conflicting. It seems to me that there is some conflict in the record as to whether there was an intent, and you said, well, maybe that's not the right word, as to whether the judge, when he made that ruling on the record, that was intended to be by the judge to a ruling granting an extension. And then, of course, we've got all these subsequent events that raise the same question. Does that principle that I just stated tie our hands in this case?
Your Honor, if to the extent it does, and I think the record is clear enough that there really isn't a fact issue regarding the effect of the court's statements on the record that day, but presuming it, even assuming that it does, the subsequent order involves no matters of confusion, but it involves nothing off the record, no comments from the court in open court. The order signed July 27th and the implications from that, we think.
But we do have to interpret, I mean, we have to basically find an implied ruling if we just look at that order. And I don't know, that just, that concerns me, especially when you're talking about notice.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you're saying that we would have to hold that you know, there was some type of constructive notice, I guess, given by the implication of the order, and I don't know if that's what the legislature intended. But
well, the totality of what the court's looking at here, we contend, eliminates any fact-finding need. There is, we've cited authority in our brief for the proposition that matters on the record are the only things that are preserved for appellate review. I understand that this is a mandamus proceeding, but the record that's before this court regarding the court's ruling and the court's intention is very clear. And there are legal implications from that.
Counsel, I'm going to have to stop you right there. You pretty much answered my question. I appreciate it, but your time's up. Thank you. Mr. Perrin?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, the court.
Counsel.
I think first I'll talk about Henry Watkins, because I think that does actually resolve this issue, and then I'll certainly get to the merits of it. As I read Henry Watkins, and as the court is certainly aware, it's brand new, it says if there's no report served, then you have a right to interlocutory appeal. If instead it's that the report is deficient and a 30-day extension is granted, interlocutory is prohibited, and so there's no mandamus either. At the core of this, I mean, I understand the distinction they're trying to draw between this is arguing about the August 21st order and the appeal is arguing about the denial of the motion to dismiss, but at the core, they're the same thing. I mean, what they're arguing is Judge Evans gave us too much time. The extension was granted either at the June 19th hearing or the July 27th order, and no admitted expert report was filed in that time. Therefore, the case should be dismissed. So ultimately, we end up at the same point, and the appeal that they filed is the proper way to resolve this. I mean, the question is, was an amended report filed in the proper time? If it was, then we end up back in front of Judge Evans, and he decides whether that amended report was good, and we probably end up back here again, no matter what he does. And if, in fact, the ruling had been made at some time, we had notice of that ruling, such that the amended report was not filed on time, then that also is resolved on appeal, on the interlocutory appeal, because that is available, and the motion to dismiss should have been granted, the motion to dismiss that was ultimately denied in the October 31st hearing. So I think Henry Watkins takes care of this. I don't think this is the proper way to get where we're going. I think the appeal that's on file, Chief Justice Casey asked about the briefing. Our brief is actually due today. It's probably being bound as we speak, and will be in the mail soon. So we are close to the end of that, and I think that's the proper way to resolve this.
Mr. Perrin, my question to you is, what is it that's not clear about the court saying, I'll allow an extension of 30 days for you to file a supplemental report on that issue?
It's a fair question, Your Honor. I would say first that this is a difficult ground, and I think you touched on it. It's difficult to get a feel for how things go when you're looking at a cold record. Again, pursuant to my affidavit, certainly my understanding when I left that hearing was that Judge Evans had not made any decision as to what he was going to do. He asked AMH to submit orders doing both things, and he was going to make up his mind as to what he was going to do. As to the language used itself, I mean, I think in this circumstance the court can go behind the record. AMH filed an affidavit saying what they think happened after the hearing. I filed an affidavit saying what I think happened after the hearing. I would submit that the fact that we've now had two more hearings in front of Judge Evans, first on my motion for rehearing and then subsequently on their motion to dismiss, where they've made the same arguments. They've said, Judge Evans, you told them June 19th that they had a 30-day extension, they should have done it then. Or, Judge Evans, you told them in that June 27th order that they had the extension, they should have done it then. And both times, Judge Evans has said, no, that's not what I did at those hearings.
Well, you know, that's part of the problem of going outside the record, which is what you've just said that we both sides have done here, is that what would otherwise be crystal clear is now confused by parties going around it and saying, well, this is what happened, though, you know, over here and over there.
Certainly.
And I'm real uncomfortable with even considering that type of evidence in a case like this. I mean, a ruling is a ruling. This is either a ruling or it's not.
And this actually, and I did want to mention this, Justice Livingston asked about what it is we're here to decide. And in addition to what constitutes notice, mm-hmm. obviously we're here to decide what is a ruling.
Right.
I mean, that's part of it as well. I mean, those two words have meaning, and determining what those two words mean is significant.
You mentioned that the hospital was asked to submit two orders. Is one of the orders this July 27th order, and then there was another order going the other way?
In fact, AMH did submit an order
That's
to the court.
Did they submit two orders?
They submitted an order to the court granting the 30-day extension. I think it was submitted on July 22nd. And so, I mean, it's
he did not sign that?
It's another thing I wanted to point out. That order was in front of the court when he signed the June 27th order, or the July 27th order, and he didn't sign the order granting the extension, which was the impetus behind my motion for rehearing and clarification. He had an order on his bench granting the 30-day extension. At the time, he signed the order sustaining their objections to our expert report, and that order wasn't signed. So obviously, as far as I knew at that point, the case had been dismissed or not, but I certainly didn't know that I had a 30-day extension.
I'm going to just play devil's advocate
sure.
with you, and I don't want you to read too much into this question, but could it be, I mean, I think a plausible argument could be made is the reason the judge signed the former order, which didn't have the extension language in, as opposed to the latter, is that he'd already made a ruling on the extension.
Well, I think maybe the easiest response to that is that's obviously not what Judge Evans thought he had done, because they made this argument to him in both the response to the motion for rehearing and in their motion to dismiss, and both times he has decided, I didn't make such a ruling until I signed the order on August 21st of 2008.
So I guess you would say that we are supposed to look at the judge's subjective intent in determining whether something that is otherwise clear and unambiguous was intended to be a ruling or not?
I think it's significant. If the question is when the plaintiff had notice of what the court was doing and what expected them to do, then what the court was intending to do certainly has something to do with what I would know about what the court was doing.
Is there any authority on that, counsel, that you know of that would give us some guidance?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. And I do want to point this out. In terms of what Judge Evans actually said at the hearing, I was looking at it again last night, and what he said is, I will allow. I mean, just by plain interpretation, that's a future intent. He's saying, I will do this. He's not saying, I am doing this. He didn't say, I'm making a ruling on the record. The cases they cite in terms of the rulings that are made orally is a court saying, I'm making my ruling right now. I'm not taking it under advisement. Here's what the ruling is. I'm not sure the language of Judge Evans is that clear, certainly not in terms of, this is my ruling, you have 30 days, go. He says, I will allow. And again, I think it's before the court. They gave you the affidavit first. I responded with my affidavit in terms of what happened after the fact. I think the fact that the court doesn't have the record from the hearing on the motion for rehearing and clarification, doesn't have the record from their motion to dismiss is also significant. I think just under standard appellate rules, it's fair for the court to assume that part of the record it doesn't have supports the trial court's decision. The trial court, again, has had the opportunity to hear this twice. On neither occasion has it decided in the way that AMH wants it to decide.
If Judge Evans was speaking in the future tense of will, I don't believe that he has the ability to do that. Once he puts you on notice, he can't, as you very well know, say, I will, beginning 45 days from now, give you. So
certainly true.
Dog hunts.
Certainly true, Your Honor. I say that only to say this seems to me to be a pretty slippery slope, particularly in a context like this when there is a deadline running from the time of notice. And so if there's going to be an oral ruling that sets forth, that starts the clock ticking on that sort of deadline, I think it would be important that it be abundantly clear that that's, in fact, what the court is doing. The fact that they submitted two orders again, I think, is significant in this regard. I mean, there were two orders before the court. He signed one. He didn't sign the other.
What else was in the other order submitted besides granting the 30-day? Did it also explicitly say, I sustain the objections, I deny the motion to dismiss, and I grant you 30 days?
No, I think all it was plaintiff's request for 30-day extension is granted, as I recall.
Well, I guess your argument then is, why would he ask for such an order and a different order unless he hadn't made his mind up?
Exactly, Your Honor.
And I assume there was no objection to that order that was signed, the July order that Judge Evans signed.
An objection that was submitted beforehand?
Yeah, no, well, at
like
any point
I made an objection
time,
to the order when they submitted it to
wait
the
a
court.
Minute, this doesn't, this leaves something unsaid or something.
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. On the July 27th order, if I can, and unless the court has other questions on that we're talking about right now, on the July 27th order, the idea that somehow the fact that the objections are sustained and that it denies all other relief and that somehow automatically means that I'm supposed to know that I have a 30-day extension, particularly, I think, in the context of the court having an order granting the extension before it and not signing it. But even more than that, the Mother Hubbard clause, I mean, I had asked for a 30-day extension in my response to their motion to dismiss. To the extent the Mother Hubbard clause, which says all relief requested is denied, to the extent they're saying that automatically denies their motion to dismiss, I think the same applies in that it automatically also denied my request for an extension. I mean, that was part of the same motion. The court said it considered the motions before it. Certainly, I had a motion on file for an extension of time to file an amended expert report. And so that order certainly is not clear, certainly doesn't give clear notice of the 30-day extension being granted.
Unfortunately, the order doesn't mention your motion when it talks about what it's ruling on.
It doesn't, Your Honor, but it says the court considered the motions before it or something to that effect.
How do you respond to some of the case law that appears to be developing that the intent of the legislature is that this is truly an extension to be tacked on to the end of the 120 days, so that really we're trying to look at 150 days, which would have ended back in May of 08. I mean, I assume you would have to toll those days if a trial court has a ruling under advisement or
right,
setting a hearing or something.
Obviously, in this case, Your Honor, we didn't even have a hearing on the motions to dismiss until after 150 days would have expired from the time. I would submit that the language is fairly clear, at least in regard to the fact that if the ruling is made after 120 days, then the 30 days runs from notice of that ruling. Again, I think probably AMH and I have both done significant research trying to find something that is helpful in this regard, and I'm not sure there is. I think you guys may be the first ones ever to have the pleasure of deciding this. I would submit again that if, in fact, an oral pronouncement, going back again to Judge Evans' intent, and I think it is significant in response to your question, certainly in terms of how the plaintiff is supposed to know to comport itself. That comes from what the judge is doing, what he's intending to do. And there's a quotation from the June 19th hearing from Judge Evans where he talks about, I'm not talking about 30 days running from when I make a pronouncement. I'm talking about when I make an order, when I make a ruling, when I sign an order. Again, reflecting his intent that what he was doing that day was not granting the 30-day extension and expecting that it was going to run from the day of that hearing.
But you'd agree he was wrong when he made that statement, that was a misstatement of the law, that a signed order was required?
I will say that there's no law out there that says a signed order is required. I think it'd be good law, and I think this court could do it if it wanted to. But I agree that there is no law out there that says there has to be a signed order under 74351 to start the deadline. Again, I guess just in summary, I would submit that we'll be here and we'll argue this again, and hopefully I'll do better than I did this time when we come back and argue it on the appellate record.
Maybe not.
maybe not. But I think the appellate record is...
Let me ask you about that. Are there issues raised in that appeal that are different than essentially what we're dealing with here? I mean, is the... Somebody suggested, I think maybe it was Mr. Tatum that, or maybe it was you, that the basis for the appeal from the dismissal or the basis for the motion to dismiss is essentially the same arguments that are being made here.
I would suggest the merits are, if not identical, almost identical.
Okay.
I mean, the question in both is, when did plaintiff have notice for ruling and when did the 30 days begin to run? And then... If they began to run when AMH suggests, then there was no amended report filed in the required time. And if it, in fact, ran from the date of the signed order, then the amended report was filed on time, okay. Which then gets us back to the merits of the amended report itself. So the merits are the same. Obviously, you know, if the court decides this on the basis of Henry Watkins, then, you know, the merits of the appeal remain and haven't been resolved. To the extent the court decided the mandamus on the merits, then I think that probably does moot the appeal.
Do you know off the top of your head if the reporter's record from the motion for clarification hearing and or the motion to dismiss hearing have been requested in the or designated in the interlocutory appeal?
They have not.
Okay.
Neither one.
Was the record made?
I was trying to remember that. There was a record made on the motion for rehearing. I'm not sure there was a record made on the motion to dismiss.
Okay.
Is the statement, I'm going to give you 30 days, is that preceding or after his statement about basically my order will begin the running of the 30 days?
It was after. I'll give you 30 days was at the very end of the hearing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Perrin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Tatum? Mr. Tatum, could you answer this question raised by Mr. Perrin regarding that this wording that Judge Evans, I will allow, in the context of other things he said in this record, was really his just signaling that this is something that I will do in the future at some point in time?
Your Honor, I don't know how you can say it any other way. I do allow, I will allow. Those are semantic distinctions, really, without a difference, particularly when you look at some of his other comments. I'll direct the court to page 31 of the reporter's record of that hearing, where the court asks Mr. Perrin if they prayed in the alternative for a 30-day extension in their response to the motion to dismiss that was being heard that day. Mr. Perrin said yes, that in fact they did pray in the alternative for a 30-day extension. The court's response is, you'd better get cracking. Yes, Your Honor. I wouldn't waste any time making cell phone calls. I mean, I wouldn't waste any time to get on the phone. I would get it done. I think that, read in connection with the court's statement that I will allow the 30 days, it can't create anything other than, the clear picture that the court wanted this done and wanted it, to the extent the court thought he would be waiting on a proposed order, waiting for a week. Justice Livingston's comments were very pertinent to this point. Waiting for a week for an order is de minimis. Waiting for 2 months for someone to submit an order, quite frankly, circumvents the whole purpose of this statute. As the court pointed out in a different context in the recent case that we've cited, the Supreme Court dealt with in a different issue, but decried the opportunity to create extra statutory extensions of time.
Just before the end of this hearing, the judge says, if I hold his report is good enough.
I'm sorry, which page are you on, Your Honor?
35, line 2. Which sounds like just before the end of the hearing, but before he does make the 30-day statement, he's still not sure. If I hold his report is good enough.
I believe he's discussing the report as it relates to a co-defendant, not to Arlington Memorial Hospital. The colloquy there was between the court and Mr. Dunnell, who represented other defendants in the case. I don't believe those comments were directed at the report as it relates to Arlington Memorial. Um, What we have here, quite frankly, and to address one question the court raised, and that is the statute regarding the 120-day time period and the intention of the legislature. The statute provides for this situation, specifically the whole notice issue. It provides for the situation where, because of court schedules and such as that, things run past the 120 days before decisions are made. It's in that circumstance that the 120-day or the 30-day extension runs from the date of notice. And that part, that's really a very important part of what we're talking about here.
Counsel, have we pretty much heard the arguments that you would be making to us in the appeal from the order denying the motion to dismiss?
Yes.
Okay.
The one thing that I might, my only observation is that there are reasons to deny mandamus review that are technical and not substantive, and so this court's decision may not moot that completely. I just point that out to the court.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tate and Mr. Perrin. You both have done a good job of representing your respective interests, and appreciate you being here this morning. We'll submit the case and ask clerk to adjourn us.
Thank you.